All right, before we actually get into the text, we're going to jump a little bit into some good old geography. So this is the map that I handed out at the very beginning of class. If you don't have a copy of that, let me know after class and I can get you one. I'm trying to refer to this map in particular just so we can kind of stay consistent throughout the course of our study. So it's probably at the beginning of your book, but I do want to take a brief look at some of the geography from chapter 6 and 7 and 8 and kind of just bring us all up to speed. It helps us understand a little bit better what's going on if we take a moment to try to understand where everything's geographically located. Some of these names and places and tribes are easy to get lost in if you don't have a place of reference. So let's take a few moments to look at that. Back in chapter 6 and verses 3 and 4, you'll remember the Midianites, the Amalekites, and the people of the east, they're coming from the other side of the Jordan. And what they're doing is they're hitting what's called the Jezreel Valley. Now, this is perhaps some of the most fertile land in all of Israel. And it's this little portion there, and it looks a lot bigger on my computer screen when I'm 8 inches away than it does whenever I've got it projected up here. But if you can see, it's this little red portion there, kind of a little parallelogram that I've got outlined there, running through the tribes of Asher, Zebulun, and I'm going to get a little closer to see that, Issachar, and a portion of Manasseh. So that's really where they would come, and a very fertile area. They come from the east, and they'd hit this, what's called the Jezreel Valley, and just raid and pillage and plunder and destroy, and really do a lot of damage in regard to where many of the Israelites would have gotten their source of food for themselves, for their animals, and that they would have used to trade with other tribes. That's the Jezreel Valley of verses 3 and 4 back in chapter 6. Gideon and his tribe, you'll remember, were introduced to him at the beginning of chapter 6. He's in this little town as a member of the tribe of Manasseh called Ophrah, and it's thought to be somewhere in this area, perhaps a little bit southwest. Now, the Amalekites would, of course, come down, and they'd just be pillaging, plundering, and raiding, you know, all the way down, all of that very fertile area. But that's where Gideon and his family were known to be. Midian and Amalek, they would have came from across the Jordan, as they did in verse 33 back of chapter 6, as they prepared to once again do what they had always done the previous 7 years. Only this time, Gideon and his men are going to be ready to meet them. And that's the battle that actually takes place in chapter 7. Now, you'll remember Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali were summoned as the primary ones who were to go to war. It's their soldiers that were really enlisted for this particular battle. And we understand that because when you look at just where the Midianites are going to be raiding at, well, it's just right in the heart of their property, right in the heart of their tribes. And so that's why those particular tribes are called together to defend that area. We've got a map a little bit from chapter 7. Just a couple of things we'll make note of here. Before the battle, chapter 7 is where the battle actually takes place. Chapter 6 is where Gideon was called and prepared, and then the signs were given him by the Lord so that he would be made ready for that role of deliverer. Chapter 7 is the actual battle itself. You've got Israel that's in their army, which is camped in Manasseh, the spring of Herod that's referred in. These are just estimated locations, but you've got Israel camped at the spring of Herod, and you got Midian on the other side of what's called the hill of Moreh. And it's there that Israel, Gideon, and his 300 men go down, and they surround the Midianites. And as the story goes, they blow their trumpets, and they break their vessels, and they shout very loudly. And the people of Midianite, through the working of the Lord, just pretty much self-destruct and implode. And as the route begins, kind of the dotted lines there trace how the Midianite army is fleeing after their first defeat at the hill of Moreh. And so they cut across there to the Jordan River, and they're getting ready to go down. So they start heading south, and it's their goal to get across the Jordan River. Now, to understand the opening comments of chapter 8, what you'll remember at the end of chapter 7, what Gideon did was he called for the Ephraimites. Now, they weren't initially summoned. It was Naphtali, Zebulun, Manasseh, and Asher that were summoned for battle. And so he sends messengers to the Ephraimites, whose land they're about to cross into, and he tells them, hey, the Midianites and the Amalekites are about to cross the Jordan. Head them off. Don't let them escape. And so at the end of chapter 7, Ephraim comes up from the south, and they continue the route that Gideon and the other tribes had previously started back at the hill of Moreh. And so they run them across the Jordan. You got two little bitty towns there in Gad, and if you're looking at your map, you'll have a better way to understand where everything's at. You got two little bitty towns there in Gad on the east side of the Jordan. One of those is Succoth, and the other is Penuel, and both of those are going to be very relevant towns as we begin our study and delve into chapter 8. And as we find out in chapter 8, the Midianites think that they've escaped from the Israelites, what's left of their army. I believe it's Karkoth, a little town that they're going to, a little area that they're going to try to rest and recoup in. And that's the geography there for chapter 8. So Succoth and Penuel are the primary towns to make note of regarding the geography of chapter 8. So with all of that out of the way, and with perhaps a little visual perspective as to where things are, where everybody's at, let's go ahead and jump into our text, Judges chapter 8. We'll look at the first 9 verses. Steve, would you mind reading that for us? So in the first 9 verses, we've got a couple of relatively controversial conversations going on. And just to say, on the outset, I've got some relatively strong opinions after having studied this text in depthly about Gideon and about his character. And you may disagree with me whenever we get to that point in time. I believe the evidence of the text and the actions of the man bear out the character that's underneath. But as we progress, that'll our discussions and our questions will be geared toward those sort of things. So if you see it the same way I do, that's fine. And if you don't, we can talk about it and still be friends after it's all said and done. There's nothing here that in this text is going to really cause any division. But there are a couple of perspectives you can take as far as the nature and the character of Gideon, the judge that's going to deliver Israel here. And so regardless of which side you're on, you know, hopefully we can have a good discussion. Okay, we've got two particular encounters here. Let's look at the first one in verses 1 through 3 where Gideon is in a position where he's seeming to butt heads with some of the Ephraimites. Now remember, at the end of chapter 7, he kind of just called them. He sent messengers saying, y'all head up to the Jordan River and keep them contained, keep them from crossing over. And so he essentially calls the Ephraimites into battle to participate against the Midianites. So let's just look at our first question and we can get some input and get some discussion going. Why did the men of Ephraim bring criticism to Gideon? Okay. Could have been jealousy. Okay, I think that's possibly part of the decision. Maybe they felt snubbed a little bit that they weren't initially called to battle. And so, well, you only call us when you need us. Well, I see how it is. Anybody else? Okay. Well, I think we're definitely going to see that a little bit later on with those other two cities. So maybe there's a little bit of fear involved. What do we know about the tribe of Ephraim? That may help us understand a little bit their reaction to what Gideon's done. Okay. It was one of the largest tribes in Israel. Remember from our lesson last morning on Hosea, sometimes northern Israel at that latter point in time, northern Israel is referred to as Ephraim, because Ephraim is the biggest tribe and really outgrows the rest of them. Some of them kind of fall off, and some of them shrink. Ephraim remains strong and remains large. And so as we look at the tribe of Ephraim, at least to this point in time, and later on in the book, they're gonna kind of demonstrate this air of superiority that perhaps some of the others don't have. And you may wonder, well, what have they got to feel superior about? Well, if you go back to Genesis 48, 13 and 14, that's really where Ephraim first comes into the picture. That's where Jacob is blessing his 12 sons, and he kind of excludes Joseph from the blessing. You remember in Egypt, Joseph had two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And he essentially says, they're going to be as my sons. And so just as he did with his other 11 children, he blesses his grandsons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, normally the way that the blessing went was, whenever this took place, the older received the larger blessing and the younger received the lesser blessing. But in this instance, Jacob was old and wasn't able to see real well. He puts his right hand to give the greater blessing on Ephraim, the younger son. And Joseph, he doesn't like that. He tries to switch him back. But Jacob, he seems to have some idea what he's doing. And so as he gives this somewhat of a divine, inspirational blessing, he gives Ephraim the larger blessing of the two. And so Ephraim, just from the get-go, is a tribe that has received a greater blessing from the patriarch Jacob. And you remember what pivotal leader came from the tribe of Ephraim? Who's that? Moses came. Joshua. Joshua came from Ephraim. And he would be a legacy to these people. And so they've got several things that are causing them to think that perhaps they may have a little more, should have a little more participation and involvement than some of these other, I'm not going to say lesser tribes, but in their mind, they don't have the same history, the same record that Ephraim does. It's prestigious. Johnny? Okay. Ephraim was a tribe of very skilled fighters. The only other one that I know that would come close would be Benjamin, just based off of reputation. Ephraim is a tribe that had a lot of skilled warriors. They had a history going back to Joshua. They had a history going back to Jacob receiving that special blessing. And so there's a lot of prestige and seems to be somewhat an idea of a little superiority here. But they're angry for whatever reason. Maybe they feel snubbed by being left out of the call. Maybe they feel left out of the decision-making process. They think that they should have been involved. Maybe they think that they were only called because the Midianites were going to pass through their tribes. So maybe they feel a little bit used. Whatever reason, they bring this criticism to Gideon after it's all said and done. Now, let's take a moment and answer this question, and I believe there's some application to make as we consider this question. How did Gideon handle this potentially volcanic situation? Okay. Yep. He demonstrates here an air of diplomacy. And I believe that that's going to be something that is lacking a little bit later on. But as Tommy mentioned, he deals with him very diplomatically. I think personally this is one of Gideon's better moments. Oh, he could have responded in any number of ways. Hey, the Lord called me to engage in this battle. You know, you're following essentially the instruction of the Lord. He could have puffed up himself and made some sort of divine calling argument. But he doesn't. As Tommy said, he deals with them with an air of humility. Verse 2, then this is somewhat of an adage that's very Israelite in nature, where he says, is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer, or Abiezer, however you say that name, his family's tribe? Essentially what he's saying is, I'm a molehill and you guys are a mountain. How could what we do compare anything to what you as a tribe are able to do? So he demonstrates some humility here as he's dealing with this very angry group of Ephraimites. And he brings out in verse 3, hey, you got the reward of the battle, where he says, you know, God has given Oreb and Zeeb, and that's some of the Midianite commanders, God has given the commanders, he's delivered them to you. You're the ones that are reaping the true reward of the battle. So he exalts the tribe of Ephraim, the men of Ephraim, and he kind of humbles himself. And as a result of that, verse 3 tells us, well, the anger of the Ephraimites subsided. Can you think of a proverb that kind of highlights exactly what Gideon has done here? Proverbs 15:1. And it's one that I was made to memorize growing up. Several from Proverbs I was made to memorize, but this one in particular, and I don't know why. I guess my mom thought me and my brothers didn't get along and we needed to have this burned into our mind. But it's a soft answer turns away wrath. And so I think that's exactly what we see here. You know, this could have gone one of two ways. It could be dealt with diplomatically, as he does, or he could have spouted off at the mouth and caused a real problem between Ephraim and some of the other tribes by insulting them, hurting their feelings, any number of things. But a soft answer turns away wrath. And there's application to be made in how Gideon deals with this potentially confrontational situation that we can make just all over. In marriage, you know, in work, with friends, with enemies, with relationships. Sometimes the best thing we can do is just humble ourselves, brag on somebody else, and a situation that might get ugly might be smoothed over a little bit. All right, any other thoughts or comments on this question, the way Gideon deals with the Ephraimites? All right, one interesting thing that's not borne out for us, that's not really showed for us in our text, is Gideon's reference to God in verse 3. And I just came across this comment, and I went and I looked at the original, and I'm not by any means a Hebrew scholar, but I do know enough, and I have enough tools in my computer to help me come to understand a little bit of what's going on. You'll remember that when God revealed himself to Moses in the burning bush, he tells him his name. Now, his name, you think about what a name does. A name insinuates somewhat of a personal connection, a personal relationship. Previously, God to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that's how he was known, as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But he communicates to Moses in Exodus his name, where he says, and the translation of that is Yahweh, or what we may oftentimes have in ours, Jehovah. But that's what he communicates to Moses. You know, this is my name. I wasn't known by my name to the patriarchs of old, but I'm communicating that to you as he prepares to enter into this special covenant relationship with Israel. Now, that's already taken place. In chapter 8, verse 3, as he's trying to soothe the anger of the Ephraimites, he doesn't use the name of God, which is used almost exclusively whenever Yahweh is the one being spoken of. Rather, he uses the term Elohim. Now, don't worry about going too deep here. Elohim is more of a generic term, and it's oftentimes used to talk about God, but it's sometimes used to talk about idols, and it's sometimes used to talk about foreign gods. And the term itself demonstrates perhaps a potential for a multiplicity of gods that is more than one. And one of the things we find out about Yahweh says, you know, I'm God alone. I'm the only God. There's no other gods before me. And so rather than using the covenant name when he's speaking to these people, he uses perhaps a term of how, the same term for that matter, how the Midianites would refer to him. He says, God, that is Elohim, has given the leaders of Midian, Oreb, and Zeeb into your hand. That's Gideon's statement in 8:3. When you go back, you find out he uses the same term that the Midianites use as they speak about the God of the Israelites back in chapter 7:14, where they say, Elohim, that's the God of the Israelites, has given Midian and all the camp into his hands. And so, rather than, you may think, well, maybe we're making a big deal out of nothing. Well, note the direction that Gideon's behavior is going to take as we proceed through the rest of the chapter. And maybe this is indicative of perhaps something that's buried beneath the surface of his character. Maybe it's making a mountain out of a molehill. Maybe you can decide as we go further on. Anyway, that's just an interesting observation that I made regarding Gideon's statement about God. And so we see, after this situation is calmed over, Gideon and his men, the 300 in verse 4, tell us, cross over the Jordan in pursuit of the Midianites, in pursuit of the Amalekites. They're looking for that complete victory. And once again, you can't help but be impressed with the hand of God as he's brought victory and deliverance for the children of Israel. We talk about sometimes in reference to history that great battle of Thermopylae, where you've got the 300 that are in between the passes and they're fending off their hundreds of thousands of enemies for this long period of time and ultimately end up dying to the last man. But here you see how, you know, a true God, the real God, delivers his people with 300 men. He brings a complete victory. Not a man was lost. And so the 300, along with Gideon, cross over the Jordan in pursuit of the Midianites. Okay, that leads us to the next question, where we see another run-in with Gideon and a potentially traumatic problem that's going to be taking place. Question 2. The two towns that on the east side of the Jordan that he enters, Succoth and Penuel, and you'll just have to forgive my pronunciation on that. Why did those two towns refuse to give aid to Gideon's army?
They were afraid of the Midianites.
Okay. They were afraid of the Midianites? Tommy?
Mm-hmm. Here
I can relate to that. These guys have suffered at the hands of the Midianites for 7 years. That, and you consider also, they weren't aware of what took place on the west side of the Jordan. They weren't aware that how many, 130,000 or 100, whatever the number was, 120,000 of the Midianites had died. And so all they see is Gideon and 300 men coming through, asking for help, asking for aid. And they essentially say, you know, have you got any trophies? Have you got any way that you can show us? We can put a little faith in this statement that you're going to defeat this army. You know, they're 15,000, you're 300. And so I think it'd just be a little bit natural to be somewhat fearful. Maybe they were afraid that if they sympathized with Gideon, then they would be making a stand against the Midianites, who would in turn come back and just utterly destroy them for the favor that they showed Gideon. And so, for whatever reason, they're somewhat fearful to give Gideon aid. And once again, this is a question that all of us could have to answer really on our own. Do you think it was right? Do you think it was wrong? What do you think about it? Barker, Brother Barker?
I think it was wrong.
Okay. They've heard stuff their whole lives. I don't know how much they've seen, you know.
Well, yeah, okay. True. But you have this history.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts on that? Anybody think they were okay to do that? My opinion is, I think it's wrong. I'm kind of with Dave. They should have shown a little faith. I say shown a little faith. They should have shown a lot of faith. It would require more than a little faith to do what they were being asked by Gideon to do. You know, if you think about just the numbers, and so oftentimes that's how we look at our problems, is we just look at the problem and the size of the problem, when really what we need to be doing is looking at God and seeing how big God is and how powerful God is and able to deal with those. While I say they were wrong, I do understand, and I do feel for their hesitancy, and I can't say if I were in the same situation that I wouldn't have done the same thing when you consider everything that they've done. But at the same time, that doesn't make their response to Gideon right. They should have had faith. They didn't have faith, and I can understand why they didn't. It would have been a tough call to make. So, I don't think they would have known, not to the same degree. They wouldn't have known to the same degree, and that's actually a point I'm going to make in one of our questions later on. So they didn't know to the same degree that Gideon did.
They didn't even know who Gideon was.
Well, that's what he said anyway. He said, I'm the smallest of my tribe. I'm the youngest in the family. So you're right. They probably didn't know who Gideon was. Okay, right. And so I think it's a pretty good reflection of the spiritual state of Israel. You know, they're enslaved for a reason. Go ahead, Dick.
It's easy for us to look at that, answer that question wrong. We think it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But from their perspective, what do you do if you just had a big army go through and then, you've been under. And were those two cities, I got a question.
Mm-hmm.
Were those two cities part of the tribe of Israel?
I believe it's part of the tribe of Gad. Let me go back to our map.
But are they?
Yep, they are part of the tribe of Gad. There are Israelite cities. So we're looking at people that should have had faith in. And I'm with you, Dick. I sympathize for the situation they were in, but at the same time, you know, even though it was a tough situation, I believe that they were wrong. I believe it's obvious that they didn't do the right thing, but at the same time, I sympathize for the circumstances that they were placed in. Dave?
That's the thing, right? That's what you have to really be careful of. Like you were saying, you have to be careful that, okay, put myself in that position, how would I behave? But I can't put myself in that position. But what do I learn from it from that practical application side is that I need to be aware of who I am in the situations I am in today and make sure that I don't behave as they did.
Mm-hmm. And when it's easy to, you know, do like they do and say no, you know, just go on by, we've got to be willing to let our faith, put our faith in action, like you say, make that decision. And that's the application. We need to walk away. We can feel bad for them all day, but we need to learn that whenever our faith may be challenged like theirs was, rather than giving in to fear, we've got to act in faith. We've got to trust in God. Tommy? Mm-hmm. But that would have set them against the face of Midian, though. You know, if Midian was going to come out of it victorious, they would have made themselves enemies of Midian by doing that. And you're right; he wasn't asking them to go to battle, but he was asking them to pick a side, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And sometimes that's what we've got to do is we've got to be willing to pick a side. I think so.
They not only had the other side, east side, the west side of Jordan, forgotten God, but the east side had too. They had forgotten that their forefathers had sworn that they would come to aid them, you know. And just overall, the spiritual condition of us.
I think it's a reflection of a people's fear and their trust in the idols and their trust in the numbers rather than their faith in God, and I think that's evidenced here. So good.
Also goes back to the failure of the priest.
The priest, Mr. John, as a failure of the leadership, Miss Johnny. It's not an easy choice to make, but it's the right choice to make.
Look at what it took against Gideon to God.
Don't say anything else. I'm going to bring that out later. All right. We need to get through these first eight verses anyway. And so as a result of their rejection to help Gideon and his army, he says, I'm going to come back. I'm going to pay you back for all of this. And so here's my question. When you see Gideon's response to their rejection, do you think Gideon's confidence has gone to his head a little bit? He's one of two things. He's confident or he's proud right here. What do you think? It's his confidence, or is he acting okay, or do you think he's acting maybe a little prideful, Dave? Okay. Okay, so he's either confident or he's proud. Just remember kind of what's happened for Gideon. He knows things the others haven't. He went up against an army of 135,000, and he's winning. He's leading the charge. But I can't get chapter 7, verse 18 out of my head. You know, remember what Gideon told the people to say whenever they blew their horns and broke their vessels and shouted, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon. And even before I came to chapter 8, that phrase just kind of stuck with me. Why would you say a sword for the Lord and for Gideon? You know, what Gideon, what have you done? You know, you've led the charge. You've stepped up and you've done a lot. But he seems to want his name involved in that a little bit. And at this point in time now, when you look at his reaction and you look at his purpose was the deliverance of the children of Israel. His purpose was to be the tool, not the source, the tool that God used to deliver his people. And so he's gone from God's purpose. God's purpose is national deliverance. He wants to free Israel from the bonds of the Midianites. But he's now, I believe, and I think further text will bear this out, he's moved from God's purpose to Gideon's purpose. I think he's acting a little bit out of personal vengeance. That's my opinion. We'll have to wait till we get to next week to actually see that. So let's just answer the last question, and we probably won't be able to do this. Was he right or wrong to threaten the cities that refused to help him? My question would just be, and I need to let y'all answer, where's the diplomacy that we saw earlier? Anyway, does anybody want to comment on this? Tommy?
Sure. The people of Ephraim, they had responded to his call for help.
Mm-hmm.
And had done their job. And they complained about it, you know, and had some peace there. And he just managed to
them. Okay.
The other people, they flat out refused to help at all. I think he had a righteous hate.
Okay. But did the people of Ephraim, you think, maybe see or know things that the others on the east side of the Jordan didn't? They possibly. I would have think they probably saw more of the battle, or would have been a little closer for home for them to have witnessed some of the things that God had done through Gideon than it would for those on the east side of the Jordan. And I'm not excusing what was done by any means by those of Succoth and Penuel.
They knew you went to fight. Verse 1 says that when you went to fight
Midian. The Ephraimites? Yeah. Yeah, the Ephraimites knew that he was at battle. So anyway, my question would be, I'm working toward this idea, maybe Gideon's acting a little bit personally. Maybe he's lost sight a little bit of what God had for him when he intended. And Johnny commented something that I was going to kind of bring out here. We don't have a lot of time to talk about it. But remember how fearful this guy was? Remember what kind of patience God had with him? And remember the signs that he was shown? I mean, he sees 3, 4, 5 different times, you know, before he's willing to step up and do what God wants. And he get these guys here, they say, okay, where's the sign, Gideon? They should have had faith, just as Gideon should have had faith, but they want to see the sign. And Gideon says, you know, I'm gonna whip your backs with briars and thistles, and I'm going to tear down this tower because you refuse to help me. And I just wonder, where did the diplomacy go? Where did the long-suffering and the patience go? So anyway, that's my thought on that. We'll talk more about this next week. Pick up in verse 10. So thank everybody for their comments and our discussion this morning.